One of them had to do with emotions. We might take a few moments and go into that. That the focus again is on the emotions primarily of the receiver. If you're transmitting, if you're the sender, to be sensitive to how they're feeling, to try to pick up their nonverbal, to pick up any types of feedback that they may offer to you. If you pick up that they're having an emotional stress, you may need to calm the whole conversation down. The few little things. Suppose that you pick up in conversation that they're something that looks like fear or stress or some type of an emotional overtone you don't know how to read. If you feel that some way your communication has been too intense for them, and that's about all you can pick up. They may frown. They may look away. They may look off to the side. They'll break eye contact. Sometime they'll get a little frown. The corners of the jaws may drop down. Just a little something to pick up. There are four or five patterns that I think will, just as a technique that helps take the pressure off of the other person. And if you want to effectively communicate to them, and some way or other you put them under pressure, you can sense that by their feedback. I suggest four or five things. One is that you gently smile. You pause from what you've been saying and put just a gentle smile on your face. And then the second thing, that if you're standing, you probably increase the distance between you and the person by 5 or 6 inches. Just slowly back up. A third thing, you lower the pitch of your voice. Especially if you've been coming at it kind of heavy. Boy, the inflections, when you get intense, you see how your voice picks up? Well, just simply lower the tone. Another thing with your voice, you speak slower. And you speak softer. If you do those things, that they are designed to help take some of the intensity off that you might have read. A person asked me, how can you tell the emotional bearing of another person? Because we've been trained not to show that. And I submit that that's true, that we have been trained. In this computer age, we're trained for the fact that emotions are illegitimate. I think that prayer is going to be and I don't mean that facetiously, I mean it honestly. That you need to ask God to give you a special sensitivity to read the emotional status of the other person. To be able to know how they're feeling. In fact, some years ago, George Sanchez shared a workshop down at Chaco Springs. Dave, I think we were down there together. And George made a point and asked a question. Have you ever asked for a generous portion of Jesus' love and empathy for other people? And I couldn't remember having done that. So that's what I did. I stopped and I asked God, Lord, please give me a generous portion of Jesus' love and empathy for other people. To be able to know how they feel. You can take that prayer one step further, but you need to do it cautiously. And that is to ask God to help you feel more how they feel. Now, if you're going to ask for that, you're going to have to be willing to bear a little bit of a burden. Because the feeling will come back and you may find yourself over-identifying. That you really are carrying too much of a load, perhaps, in behalf of someone else. But I think it's totally legitimate to ask for a generous portion of love and empathy to know how they feel. And then I think you'll be able to pick up. Suppose you can't. You've prayed that and you've done all that you know, but you sense something's there. I suggest very sensitive use of questions. The other evening, it hasn't been but just a few weeks, I was speaking to a group that had come from another state, and I'd finished, and two or three fellows had buttonholed me up there to talk to me about some other things, and I glanced at a young lady that just walked by, and it was as if God spoke it into my mind. She needs some help. You get over there and talk to her. That was a strange impulse. I get it on occasion, but it's not a regular thing. So I concluded my conversation as quickly as I could. I went over. The young lady showed no signs of anything out of order. And I smiled at her and introduced myself and said, could I help you in any way? I didn't know any other question to ask. She broke down and started crying. She was under intense emotional stress. We withdrew to the blue room over there and got a table and a chair back off in the corner. And I just listened to her for a little while. But the emotional stress was so heavy. A young man had told her that she didn't know how to deal with girls, that she hadn't trained her girls properly, and that she was a failure. And Boy, that tore all to pieces. And she said, I so wanted to be successful before God. I wanted to do the best for the girls. And she's carrying on what he had told her. I said, well, let me ask a few other questions. Do you girls have a consistent quiet time? She said, yes. Are they doing their Bible study? Yes. Do you see God working in their life through the Word? Oh, yeah. Have they been memorizing Scripture? Yeah. Have you ever had them out in evangelism? Oh, sure. We go out all the time. Have you ever seen any fruit from evangelism? Well, yeah, nearly every one of them's led somebody to Christ. Any of them been helping them do follow-up? Well, yeah, they're consistent at that. I said, that's one of the greatest success stories I've ever heard. I said, that's what we're committed to try to do. I said, I don't know who the guy was who told you that, but I'd be willing to stand up and bold-facedly contradict him. You're not a failure, you're a success. I said, let me go on a hunch of mine and ask, has he been trying to, does he have his eye on one of your girls? And she said, yeah, I think he does. Well, you know how that story probably ended. Now, what it was, he was upset because the girl wasn't responding to him the way that he wanted, and he took it out on the leader. But to be able to read the emotions, to ask some questions, to get that unloaded out before you so you can find out what the problem is, and to do it lovingly and sensitively and encouraging. And if you can identify with them, they'll know that you're identifying. And they'll respond to you even more. In fact, you'll find that your counseling opportunities probably multiply, maybe even beyond where you would want them to go. So I think emotions are very important, and they do need to be considered. Your own emotions, of course, if you're angry, you know, that's going to communicate. And if you're upset, that'll probably communicate. So why are your emotions? You need to get that straight first. And it may be that you have to put off some conversation until a later time. Were there any more questions that we probably should pursue from this morning's time? That one on emotions had come up in private. Okay, why don't we pick up where we left off? That we've basically developed a communication process as far as the block diagram is concerned. There are several other things we need to consider for a few minutes. Let's deal some over here in the area of the channel. That the verbal and the nonverbal. It's a very critical area. If what you say is contradicted by how you look, what do you think people will believe? What they see or what they hear? Almost invariably what they see. Do you believe that? Let me demonstrate it. This is the saddest day of my life. You wouldn't know why you could believe that, is it? Or here's one that's really home. I mean, it strikes home. Angry? Where did you get the crazy idea I'm angry? No, I'm not angry. What's the matter? Nothing. You ever heard that? Nothing. The facial expression say, lots is wrong with me, and the answer is nothing. That the nonverbal is so critical, people will believe what they see. And they'll attribute all kinds of things. Let's do a little nonverbal check. Let's change no facial features, nothing but the set of the jaw. Okay, let's drop it about 10 or 15 degrees. This is pretty much straight ahead, best I can tell. I'm going to lower my jaw about that much. And when I come by and look at you, you tell me how you feel about me. What does it make you feel like? Chew somebody out. Sadness. Stern. Judgmental. Grim. Suppose I come into it. I'm looking straight ahead and then all of a sudden. Did you identify with him? Did you sort of feel as an us and them principle? I'm trying just to keep it us all the way. But once I break it off, if I come too intensely on any one person out here, I know what'll happen. See, it'll split the group. It'll polarize it. You'll be the us, and I'll be the them. And I don't want that to happen, so I'm not going to dwell on that very long. Let's raise it about 10 degrees, 15 degrees. What does that make you feel like about me?
You're snooty. Back to the arrogant.
Arrogant, snooty.
You smell something bad.
Well, would you believe that nearly everything you just mentioned is a character trait for me? Arrogance, judgmental, snooty. grim. Offer some dumb thing like the set of my jaw. That's if you think about it intellectually. But we don't think about it intellectually, do we? We have a response in communication that's basically not intellectual. It's how does it make you feel? You say, well, very few people do that. I beg to differ with you that there are lots of people who do those types of things. And most of us have some quirk or another that will distract other people. Suppose it's the eyes. Now, 1/64 of an inch will show even on the back road. You see that? Just ever so small of a squint of the eyes shows, even for a long way off. You know, and if you had a pattern of squinting, what does that make you feel like? Yeah, it's kind of a strange feeling, isn't it? Then suppose you look at it, come into that. Somebody, just bring him into it. Don't do it to me. You get all kinds of unusual feelings. The nonverbal has lots of intensity to it. We need to soften the intensity. Yes, sir.
Regarding yourself, did you say these are character traits of yours, or these are things that people read because of the way you said?
Well, I thought that I said that the things that you attributed to me were character traits. In other words, the words you used are character traits that you attributed those. I asked you, how did it make you feel about me? And as you were calling those words, you were really attributing, saying that that's the way it made you feel about me. That would probably be my character, when really, I don't think that's true.
You're not admitting to
it. No, I don't really admit to all those. In fact, I think most of them are honestly not my character traits. I've got some others. A fellow asked me, what problems are you working on? That is, those that you know about. And they're those that I know about. I know about some of them. But I think basically that snooty is probably not one of my traits. I don't think arrogance is. Occasionally I can get intimidating when I get angry. My children have told me that, so I have to accept that as truth. That doesn't happen an awful lot, but it does happen. That's the open confession. There's a lot more. We can have a confession time. I got a long list of them. But no, I'm saying that really the nonverbal patterns caused you to attribute certain characteristics to me, and basically I don't believe they were true. I was playing a game with you by demonstrating those. But there are a lot of things that add intensity. The eyes, the jaw, the set of the mouth. This one. The pouty. Yes, sir, Dave?
Bill, I was just thinking one of the things that helped me to use care with me before was when I had a mustache. And because I don't smile very big anyway, and the mustache would come down over the corner of my lip, people would think that I was angry or unfriendly. And when I shaved that mustache off, I could actually tell a difference in the way people would initially respond to me.
Now, that's a testimony, and that is a unified testimony. That'll carry across the board. I don't know if you got the idea of what he meant by crook. And I thought I had a blank overhead someplace, but I guess I don't. I was going to draw. Here we are. I was going to draw a little bit about what he's talking about. I'm not suggesting that you have to shave a mustache off. What I'm going to suggest is you might want to consider some factors about it and at least be aware of some things that are going on. I don't know if green will show it up, but it probably should. Let's turn it around. If I could draw, this would help now. Those two fellas, about the same degree of intensity, would you say? You don't really feel altogether threatened by them. That's supposed to be a no facial response. Now let's put a mustache in on both of them that's straight across. Feel about the same? Let's hook the mustache on this fella. Who's the most intense fella there? Is that evident? That the hook will add a lot. And if you don't have a pronounced smile, you only have about 16 square inches to differentiate. Maybe 20. And if you cloud up what you do have by covering it up, then you're going to you're paying a price. So the question is, you know, is that what you want to do? And I'm not preaching against mustaches or beards. What I'm trying to do is identify that there's an intensity factor. Now, we saw it with another fella who had not had a beard and grew a beard and then shaved it off, and he went through all that pattern. He could very carefully identify with a thing that that we probably could call intensity. That another pattern you need to know, that if you don't know Dave, you may want to glance back. He has dark, very dark hair. That the darker the hair, the more the intensity. Darker colors tend to be more intense than light colors. Intense meaning more on the depressive end, a little more threatening. You know that's true if you'll think about it for a moment. So the color of the hair, the amount of the hair, how much of your features are you covering? See, you'll smile, you show teeth, but you also show... See, Dave, when he smiles, but one of the positive aspects, he's got a ring on either... I'm not meaning to single him out there. He's about to blush on me. But about right around here, he's got a line on either side that really softens. And when I can see that, it adds softness to me. It detracts from the intensity. Now, that's just a little thing that we talked about. He was reading some intensity, and that's why we talked about intensity. There's several other things, some of them that we can't do anything about. The color of the eyes. The darker the eyes, the more the intensity. So once you know that, then you know that what you have to do is soften it a little bit. That means a little more smile, a little more gentleness in the voice, some other patterns. We've got the glasses problem. Now, I've got really a problem. I've got three of these things in mind. I got trifocals, and I'm still trying to find out where to look to see everybody, keep from falling in the ditches and not having to do like this to get a guy in focus up close. But I have basically a farsighted correction. It tends to make my eyes look larger. Bob Bird has a fairly significant farsighted correction. I can tell by glancing at his lens. The fellow behind him has a nearsighted correction with some fairly significant astigmatism just by looking at the lens. We have several over here on this side who have a myopic correction. And there's nothing you can do about that. That's the way it is. You need the correction in order to see. But the myopic correction makes your eyes look smaller. That gives you just a hint of a squint when you really aren't. And people will pick up on that. They feel a little bit more intimidated by it. So what you do, you soften it with your voice and with a smile and by keeping that eye contact direct. And if you ever pick up that somebody's feeling intense, those little five patterns will do much to soften it up. We are actually on nonverbal communication because it's so, so important. And almost everything communicates something. One young fellow said that his motivation for going, he had a lot of facial hair, and I asked him, why did you do that? I'd just be curious to know the motivation. He said, well, he's ministering to the students. I said, which students? The majority or the minority? He said, well, so many of the students wear beards. I said, have you ever checked it on this campus? He said, no. I said, I took the opportunity to sit in the student lounge and check 200. I just had a little tick mark with yeses and the noes. I said it was 82-18. 82% did not. 18 did. I'm told that there are other campuses where it's reversed, that there are campuses. So you may want to do that, see? But you need to get the motivation right. Are you really doing what you think you're doing with it? And you need to know that with some groups of people that you will pay a price because that's simply the way that it is. And so you run that through and you pray over. And if God wants you to do that in order to relate, then, boy, that's hallelujah course. I'd recommend you to do it. I talked to one fellow. I said, no way I'm going to be able to identify with you guys. I can't grow it. I mean, I just can't get in the door. I can't match the uniform. Uniform with long hair, and that ruled me out. I could buy some, and if God called me to deal with those fellas, I'd probably buy me a hairpiece. As hard as I hate to think about that. But I pretty well decided that that's the way it would be if I had it to do. Now, there are certain stances that threaten. Does one hand in the pocket threaten you? Does this threaten you? What about this? Does that threaten you? What about this? That's a little more threatening. Maybe for some, maybe not so much for others. What about this? Some yes, some no. What about this? See, that wasn't but what? Inch and a half? Suppose you drop 1 foot back. That, you know, that's kind of intense, isn't it? So there are a lot of things that do and a lot of things that don't. If you're sensing that something is adding intensity to communication, you may want to soften it. Why would you want to soften it? They're feeling intensity from your communication, from you. See, then they start accusing you of things. They'll accuse you of being hard, of not caring, of no feeling, of a long list of things. And you'll find out they keep asking you qualifying questions. You made a simple statement and they want to know more about it. They're not willing to take the chance of incurring your wrath, when honestly you may not feel wrathful at all. Is there someone here who hasn't done this little exercise with me that's about 5'8"? Somebody about my height? Who's 5'8"? Yes, sir. Maybe you could help me if you would, please. If you'll stand right over here by the bench.
5'8¼. 8¼.
That's all right, Neil. We'll go with that. If you'd back up just a bit, and I'll back up a bit. Now, Neil and I are acquaintances. We're not dear friends, but just acquaintances. And the setting is that I'm down in the Citadel, and I run up on him. I see him across the way over there. Now, if you will just drop your hands and look straight ahead at me. I said, "Hi, Neil." And he responds, "Are you comfortable with this? What would you like to see us do? Get a little closer." Okay, now I'm going to come. You don't pay attention now. I'm going to start walking kind of slowly. And the plan is that when I get to the distance where you'd feel comfortable to have just a conversation, just the two of us, that you say stop. And I'll keep coming until it feels about right. And then you say stop. And you let me know when. Right there. Okay, right there. Are you comfortable? Are you comfortable with him? Normally among American males, it's about an arm's length and 4 to 6 inches. He may be a skosh close. Some of you felt that it was. Did you? Probably not. It's about right. It's an arm's length and 4 inches for me, maybe five.
Is that for a stranger?
I know that's for people that you know. Now, I'm going to close this space envelope. What do you want him to do? Do what you feel like doing. He leaned back.
Naturally
he'd go back. Now, he's got one other option. What is his other option? No, that won't do too good. That'd make me nervous then.
No,
I've had that one done too. Turn sideways. Both of us turn sideways. That didn't make it too bad, did it?
No, that's not bad.
That's not bad. See, and we're in there a lot closer. But you can see the point. Thanks a lot, Neil. It's not true of Asians. What is it in Asia? Less or more? What did you notice in Taiwan, Ken?
Closer.
In Taiwan. What about Korea? Anybody spend time in Korea? I noticed among Koreans that at least initial introductions, that they liked it about 4 feet. Yeah, so they can bow without bumping heads. I don't know what it's for, but it was a broader space envelope. Anybody spend time in Latin America? Well, have you observed Latins in communication? They get real close, and that's in capital letters, that real. That's like the word lots. They get real close. Bob, you'd remember Jess Morado. He's a Mexican-American. I came in one day after having taught a class of foreign officers, and I was a nervous wreck. He could tell I was so tense, and my hands were watery. And I just came in, all but fell in my chair. And he said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "Well, I've just been teaching those foreign officers. Especially I had some time with my Venezuelan officer." And he grinned. He said he violated your space envelope, didn't he? I said, "Well, he more like destroyed it." That he got in there close, man, and I backed up and kind of hurriedly, and he did it again, and I had nowhere to go. I was against the wall. Then he got in, put his shoulder next to mine, put his arm around my neck. And I could decipher whether it was garlic or onions. I mean, we were close. I mean, close. I couldn't hear a word he said. Nothing. It blanked out. I was so nervous. So the nonverbal is very, very important. And it can all but destroy a conversation. Now, I said American males. Why didn't I say American females? Are they? Some say closer, some say farther. And that's what I say. Some say closer and some say farther. And it's not consistent. Yes, sir.
I was going to ask, and I've observed that it's not consistent with males either. And I've had guys who, you know, the thing I read on it was that the way to find it out is just let the guy come closer and closer until he stops, and then you find out what it is, what his is.
Yeah.
That way, and I've noticed that certain people, you know, it'll be like that far. I mean, they'll get like this far away from your face.
How do they make you feel when they do that?
Well, I've just adjusted to it.
Well, he's adjusted to it, and that's part of the space envelope. It has been violated. You know how many times I've done this? Scores of times. And you know the furthest off a man, he had no idea what I was working for. You know the furthest off it's been with him telling me? You want to guess? 2 inches. The furthest variance between American males is 2 inches. Now, that's for people telling you that they feel that way. And the guy who said it was off wanted me a little closer. He did like it a little closer. Some people like it closer, but the basic pattern for American males is about an arm's length and 4 to 6 inches. And the way to shatter that is for you to violate it, and you'll cut off his communication. I think the suggestion that Cal is giving is the one I wanted to offer you, that if the guy violates yours, can't you decide you're going to hold your ground anyway? How tall are you, Cal?
Just about 6 feet.
Who's taller than 6 feet in here? Okay, John, would you help me with it? Let's do a little bit of an exercise here with a taller fella. And a. Okay, I'm going to show you what a fella that was 6 foot, what are you, 6'2"?
Mm-hmm.
He was 6'3". And he came and stood about this close to me. Now, I don't even have to look at him. Does that make you uncomfortable in my behalf? It really made me uncomfortable. See, to look at him, look what I have to do. And that fellow looked down at me and he said, I've been here 2 days with these men, and they seem to be cliquish. They don't seem to accept me into their group. He's talking loud, he's got a barky voice, and he's standing right there, you know, enveloping me. He said, you think you could offer me any suggestions? And I said, yeah, I think I could offer right there. I just wanted you to get the feeling to what it feels like to, for a small fella to be confronted. That's what that is a confrontation. That when I decided, just like Cal said, I decided with that fella, I am not going to move. But it was hard. And then I said, well, let me show you where I'm comfortable. And I got out arms length 4 to 6 inches. I said, now when we add about 3 or 4 more inches to your height, which you have, I feel better back about another 3 or 4 inches. Then I suggested speaking a little softer and with a little less intensity in the voice. Plus, he also had a strong nonverbal frown when he was talking about things that bothered him. So, yeah, I felt intimidated. Other guys, you know, they'd glance up at him and they'd look around, and first opportunity, they'd be gone because they just weren't going to put up with that. When you violate space envelope, you just need to be aware of that. And you, like I think Cal's suggestion, if somebody violates yours, make up your mind. If you want to continue with the conversation, you can stand the ground. Now, with ladies, I make a suggestion because I don't know whether they like it open or closed. And it's hard for me to tell. I normally will stop just outside of a space envelope, about an arm's length and 8 inches, something like that. If they extend their hand, I'll step forward, shake their hand, and then ease back to my original position. And if they want to come in, that's all right. But I'm not going to move in to violate theirs. And then, it just works smoother that way. And what you do is take advantage of what could be a problem by not letting it happen. Yes, sir. When you're sitting, it will vary. The distance, and they've done multitudes of tests. They put chairs with easy to move wheels on. And they'll put them in positions and then let you see. You'll move them back to where you feel comfortable. If you put them straight ahead, it's about 4 feet. If you turn them ever so slightly at an angle, and even if you, especially if you put a little table in between them, then they can stand the chairs about half that distance, 2 feet. If you put them at a different angle, then there's a different feeling with it. But it does make a difference in how you're sitting. Are you straight away to somebody, or are you turned sort of sideways to them? Significant difference.
Are there other positions that are offending in sitting position?
Well, I think too much of a slouch would be, slouching down in a chair, especially if it causes you to come like this. See, it makes you drop your chin to keep eye contact straight ahead, but see, your chin's way down. And I think that would be a little bit threatening to some people. Too much draping over the chair. Some people don't like that. Some people don't like really to have the chair turned around. You sit in backwards because you lean over this way, see, and you got your head high. It's just a hint. More innuendos. It's subtle. It's not the kind of thing that you can come out and say, boy, I know exactly what happened. But it's there. We've got this video equipment now the Lord's provided for us, a little closed circuit deal, and you can trap a lot of those things right on it. I call it self-confrontation. We go at it as gently as I know how, but some of the things are a little bit intense anyway. And it tends to, because it's black and white, it tends to add intensity to what's already there. Yes, sir.
I was given a workshop one time, practiced, and I have the habit of leaning forward on the table if there's one in front of me. And that conveys a lot of intensity. Several of them said I was too domineering or overpowering when I said something. Said I came on too strong.
Yeah, you see, a lot of our communication can give the impression of domineering. Some of us may be domineering. Others may not feel that way, but come across as domineering. And I'm amazed at how many people that are that way that don't believe they're that way. You know, I get all kinds of agreement when I travel. And yeah, that's right. But it's always for somebody else. The idea of, am I that way? Who could probably tell you how you are? Who?
Your wife?
Your children? Who else? Yeah, men in the ministry? People who know you fairly well can tell you. Was there a question? I thought I... Yes, sir. Yeah, and even then, if you do offend one person, if others could tell that that person's offended, even though they aren't, guess what happens? That's right. It's the empathy, the us-them principle. Even if they deserve it, if you don't do it effectively and do it sensitively and lovingly. So you can get away with a lot if your nonverbal supports it. I was in a Bible study one time, and a young fellow had been critiquing it, the performance of another individual, and really shattered him. I mean, had attacked him in there. And the guy was feeling low. He just sank down his chair. That all the negatives, and they were piling up. And everybody was feeling this way. I was, my head was down the floor. I didn't even want to look up. And then he said, would anybody like to say anything? I said, yeah, I've got a suggestion. I said, you know, if we could soften our pattern a little bit and reestablish the fact that we cared for the guy, and then we could probably deal directly with him. So I looked over at the fellow and I smiled at him big. His name was Lauren. I said, Lauren, in my estimation, you probably blew that one. And he said, yeah, I guess I did. He grinned and we started laughing about that. It was funny. I said, yeah, I did blow it. I said, let me offer a couple of things that might help. And I offered him one and I offered him two and told him specifically how he might do those. He said, yeah, hey, that makes sense. And the guy went out of there encouraged. I thought, hallelujah. You know, the intensity was removed. Even though I told him as brutally as I could think of the words, you blew it. But I didn't say it that way. With a nonverbal, I told him, look, man, I like you anyway. It doesn't matter to me if you sank the ship right in the harbor. That's all right. I love you anyway. The Navy might be upset, but I'm not upset. So you see the idea that if a guy can read that love and acceptance, that you're really moving along. Well, I think those ideas probably a little bit on nonverbal, and that is very little. The way you check that is somebody can give you feedback, or if you get a chance on that video. Boy, that's awfully penetrating, the video is. So if some of you, particularly if you've sensed that you may have what might be termed a remedial situation, meaning you know there's some difficulty and you're not sure what it is, that if you're out this way sometime, again, your schedule probably won't allow it, as I looked your schedule over. But some other time that you may want to use that video. Maybe we could sit down together and make a little recording. I'd like for us to switch gears and make a specific application of a point that we've talked about. We've talked about feedback. And I'd like for us to consider that more in detail. We've got a handout here. If I could get a little help, we can get those out. The concept of effective feedback. Now, you've communicated, or someone's communicated to you, and you want to give them feedback. You can do that by nodding of the head and smiling. But let's talk more about the verbal feedback. Something's happened or been done, and you want to tell them, give them your response. There's some suggestions that might make that easier to do, especially if you're looking at it as if it may be a negative feedback. Positive feedback's pretty easy to give. At least I contend that it is. However, there are quite a few people I've known that I would question whether they understand that principle.
Did you say that again?
I think, personally, positive feedback is easier to give than negative feedback. But I've seen some people around that I wonder if they know how to give positive feedback, that all I've ever heard has been negative. But I think we do need to focus a little bit on that subject. Now, as we look at feedback, there are two primary focuses we can make. And I think that there's one focus that's better than the other. For example, I'd suggest that we focus on the behavior that we've seen as opposed to the person. Now, we can talk about the behavior and it becomes an it. Anger. One thing I've observed, and I might describe it. And we might agree that anger is a difficult situation. We might talk about anger in great detail. We can do a Bible study on anger. But that's not the you. Who is the you involved? Well, the you is a child of God. The you is a joint heir with Jesus Christ. And I have to wonder, is that totally legitimate for us to attack the you? Even if it's an attitude problem. I think I had rather discuss the attitude as opposed to you. I'm very uncomfortable. Joe, I noticed one thing about you. I believe you're a loser. You know, just for a mild introduction. I know specifically of a very recent case in which a person was asked to move into a training apartment, and the answer that they gave was no. Then the person turned around and said, well, it's evident that you're not willing to pay the price. You know, the you, the downgrading, the degrading, the attack. There's an impact to that. It's depressing. It's a little threatening. And in a lot of cases, it leads us right into sin and trying to defend ourselves. But if we could deal with the behavior, it comes off a lot smoother. We can talk about anger, you see, as an it. And it's not nearly so threatening. So the behavior is opposed to the person. To deal with observations instead of inferences. Do we make very many inferences in life? I wonder, how you do with a little test? I've got a little test here. 10 questions. You can hold that handout you just got. Keep it in your lap. And this one's called The Story. It's 4 lines. It's an open book test. You can read it, the 4 lines, as often as you want to. So you read those and then proceed to answer the questions. There'll be some questions asked, and they have 3 responses. If the story says it's true, then you mark it T. If the story indicates very clearly that it's false, you just simply mark it false. If the story does not give you enough information to know, you mark it question mark. So it's all in accordance to what the story says. So if you would, and don't take a lot of time. We're not going to grade these and post them on the wall. But I'd like you to read through the story and then proceed to answer those questions. And it doesn't require meditation, just a little thought. You should be at least halfway through. Okay, most of you are through. A simple test, wasn't it? Obvious answers, right? So let's take them one at a time. Question one, a man appeared after the owner turned off his store lights. What's the answer?
Question mark.
Several of you look startled with that. Yes, it's question mark. Why is it question mark? You don't know if the businessman and the owner are one and the same person. They could be, but they may not be. The story simply did not tell that. Question two, the man who appeared opened the cash register. What makes it question mark? Yeah, could not the man who appeared have been the owner? The story doesn't say that. At least that one up in the air. You made an inference on that one, some of you. It's question mark. It's awfully easy to infer a thing, isn't it? When it really isn't clearly stated. Number three, the man who appeared did not demand money. False. Now, the rationale for that is that this is an easy one to keep up your morale. Number four, the man who opened the cash register was the owner.
True.
What made it question mark? Was the owner a man?
No.
We don't really know that, do we? But said the man who, number three, said the man who appeared did not demand money. It says a man appeared and demanded money, so that would make that one false. It's a little tricky in a reading of that because it's a negative phrase question. Don't want to make them too easy. Let's see, which one are we on now?
Five.
The store owner scooped up the contents of the cash register and ran away. Yeah, it may seem unlikely, but the story does not really preclude it. So it's question mark. Number six, someone opened the cash register.
True.
Guess what the rationale is. Number seven, the story concerns a series of events in which only three persons are referred to. The owner of the store, a man who demanded money, and a member of the police force. What makes it question mark? That's right. The businessman and the owner, are they one or are they two different people? The same goes really for the owner and the man who appeared. We don't really know that. We make inferences on it. Eight, a businessman had just turned off the lights when a man appeared in the store. What makes it question mark?
He doesn't
say it was in the store. That's right. It could have been at the door or a window. It doesn't say that he actually entered the store, does it? Number nine, while the cash register contained money, the store does not state how much. What makes it question mark? That's right. It said contents. Could have been money. We don't know. Number 10, question mark. Could have been coupons. The contents of the cash register. Yeah, they are a little tough. They just look simple. They're not really all that simple. Number 10, the following events were included in the story. Someone demanded money, a cash register was open, its contents were scooped up, and the man dashed out of the store. Boy, we had a right span on that one. True, false, and question mark. The keyed response is dashed. Could he not have sped away on roller skates or in a car? We do not know that he actually left the store. As a matter of fact, we don't even know that he entered it. That what we've done is made a series of inferences based on a real simple situation. Four lines, four sentences, and the biggest word in there had three syllables, but it was something like demanded. There really was not that much confusion to it. Was there? Yeah, it was designed to show how frequently we make inferences. See, we infer a thing in our communication. Something happens. We hear what was said. I went by to to talk to a person fairly recently about a situation, to offer an apology and to let them know that I did not hold them accountable for a thing that had occurred. I said it as clearly as I could. I stated it twice. And then I got feedback from another source that they thought that I was holding them accountable. You know, it's just almost totally ridiculous. Bob was telling me about a situation that he's had out where he works. That it came back 180 degrees out. How does that happen? We say a thing, we try to reinforce it non-verbally, we do the best we know, and yet it'll come back to us off track. And I think one of the key reasons is, especially with the words, that we infer. You know the little whisper game where you whisper a thing, you start off with a little sentence and it goes around. It never comes back the same. I never have seen it in my life. It's nearly always distorted. We cannot simply say the words correctly. We make inferences. We get a visual image and we infer off that. We hear a thing, we see a thing, and we get it off track. Yes, sir? Yeah, earlier remember I said that it takes two who desire to communicate, two or more. That a person who doesn't want to do it is going to confuse it. He'll make a point to do that. And one of the reasons is to try to maybe aggravate you a little bit. But a fellow who's really trying, even the guys that try, we'll get the thing off track. And one of the reasons is inferences. Yes, sir.
I was just going to make this comment. This past year, a series of events took place that really focused, for me, the need to be very careful about the words we use to describe something, either about ourselves or someone else. And the particular word we used in this case was this person was desperate. And the person was not really desperate. But what did that communicate? They could be willing to, shoot their, blow their brains out or...
Yeah.
Something else. And I hadn't really thought about that. We really need to be accountable for the words we use in situations.
Yeah, accuracy of the words. And don't overstate it. Yes, sir.
Would you say then, from what we're saying, that in some situations you would be better not to communicate too deep of a level with some people? Because they may not be able to deal on a deep level of communications? Or?
No, I think you might have to approach it slowly and build up to it. You may have to visualize and demonstrate even some of the things you're saying. Particularly if your nonverbal is not supportive of your verbal, you may have to show them. Yes, sir.
What's tough is getting your observation so you don't imply also.
Exactly. This very same thing. Yeah. See, you saw a mental image off this. Had you seen a thing occur, you still would have had, probably would have had a few inferences off of that because that's the way we operate. I had someone visit us from the Knoxville area, Dave, in the last year. And they said, well, something in the discussion about dating. And that they recognized that we really didn't approve of dating prior to engagement or something. And I said, where did you get that idea? Well, everybody knows that. I said, well, tell me how you got it. I'd be curious to know. They said, well, I observed that you moved two guys in your home and both of those quit dating. I noticed that you had worked with one other fella earlier than that and he'd quit dating for a while. So we just assumed. Oh, you just assumed. I said, did you ever notice what my daughters did? Did they date? Yeah, they did. Do you think I would have let them date if I'd have been an anti-dater? I said, let's take those guys one at a time and let's describe where they were, what was going on in their life. Two of them said, we feel that we should stop dating for a while till we get a handle on what to do with girls. That's not bad, is it? That was their decision. That wasn't mine. A third one of those guys, I asked him, I said, I observed you relating to a couple of girls. I saw this and I saw that. It led me to wonder about a question. Let me just ask it. And I asked the question. He said, yeah, I did have a bad attitude, et cetera, et cetera. I said, what do you think you ought to do about it? And he said, well, I think I probably ought to withdraw from dating for a while till I get the handle on that in my life. I said, is that your decision? He said, yeah. I said, it sounds right to me. But you see how you make an inference off that? You made an observation and then you make a conclusion based on selected instances without asking. See, what do you do to find out? You ask. See, if anybody had asked me, they would know that I am emotional on that subject. That I am not an anti-dater. See, when you arbitrarily separate guys from gals, to me, you've interrupted the concept of the unity of the body. That you can't say that girls have to be totally separated from guys. Now, I'm not in favor of running to the woods and necking and that kind of thing and shacking up with a gal. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is just a relationship with them, that a guy and a gal ought to have an opportunity. I've just been eternally grateful that I was married, that God gave me my wife, that I was able to court her. And I saw God's hand in that, and that we got married. Without someone trying to override that by saying that there's no way you can date. George Sanchez feels heavier on this than I did. And he was told me personally that he was intending to write a book to show a biblical base, at least for relating. Not necessarily the other thing where you get lost in the maze. And the key leaders around here, they're not anti-daters. Let me assure you of that. But do you see how the inference got on me? And I got the title, the dubious title. Have you had people and make inferences about you? Sure you have. So what does it behoove us to do? To ask a few questions. Say, I've got a question. Let me ask it. Or something that would help me to understand what I observed. And then you say what you observed and ask your question. A person will respond to that. And the question now needs to be a little sensitive. If you say, why did you do that? What does that imply? Why did you do that? That I judged it and it was wrong. That's already condemned. Man, you are guilty and you have had it. Defend yourself or else be quiet. Yeah, just how we ask the question. So somebody said that did that one day. I was in a group. And incidentally, the things we're talking about now are group applications. In the coming days, just immediately ahead for you. Group applications. When you ask a question to one of your co-laborers, ask it with a little sensitivity. A guy had asked a question, and I said, that seemed to me to be just a bit threatening. The question, I rephrased the question, didn't tell him, now you were threatening. See, I told him the question seemed to me to have an overtone of threat, and I described some of the things. He said, well, how else do you ask the question? And I said, well, I think I can demonstrate it. Just give me an opportunity. I said something like this as we were discussing the subject. It certainly would help me to understand your position if I understood why. Maybe you could share with me why you took that position. I was looking for his motivation. See, that was a lot less threatening, wasn't it? Lots less. Voice intonation, a little smile. Not just frown, well, why did you do it? Boy, you know, the questions. Or suppose we take the big leader stance. Why did you do that? He doesn't even have to be a frown. Just have the solemn tone about it in the voice. Well, when are you going to start? See? Very serious nature about that. Boy, it adds a threat. So to ask the question by considering the other person's feelings, their emotions, their knowledge, their values, and so on. But inferences are on top of us. You make observations. And it's probably best to go with descriptions of those as opposed to judgments. The behavior, how did you find out about the behavior? You observed it. Then what do you do with the observed behavior? You describe it. Now, if you do the opposite, you'll find yourself focusing on the person. You are an angry person. And anger, in this case, is a sin. We make a judgment and call a fellow's hand on it. If a fellow's not willing to go our route all the way through, like you invite him into a training apartment, he says, I don't think I should do that. So many times we'll judge that. We'll make an inference. That behavior says he's not willing to pay the price. What else is wrong with him? What else do we say about him? Not available. What else?
Unteachable.
One more. He's what? Rebellion. That's even the one I didn't think that's true. Uncommitted, unfaithful, not responsive to leadership. Do we make those inferences? See, I have to run a heart check on some of those. I've made some of those myself. I'm sorry. That's truth. And it's prayer in my heart. God, please, help me to stop that. I learned something from my youngest daughter years ago when she was, I guess, 5 or 6. She had disobeyed and I confronted her. And I said, what you did was disobedience. She said, yes, it was. I said, what is disobedience? I said, what does Ephesians 6:1 say? She says, I don't want to tell you. I said, tell me anyway. Well, it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. I said, what did you do? She said, I disobeyed. I said, what are you going to do about it? Well, Daddy, I know what I have to do. I'm sorry I did that. And she said, I'll go take care of it. So she went back to her room, was quiet for a little while. I just debated whether or not I was going to spank her, but she showed a repentant attitude toward me and said she was sorry. And that's what I was looking for, was repentance and turning. So that night I put her to bed, and with her mother and I used to take turns. And I said, you want to pray or you want me to pray? And she said, oh, I'll pray. So she began. She was there for a while. She took a deep breath. God, I'm sorry. She paused and she said, help me not to do it anymore. She just called out with a plea, and I teared up. And I thought, you know, that's the way I ought to be in my heart. God, help me not to do that anymore. Cry unto me. See, how many times do we cry out to the Lord, especially about an issue like that? Help me not to do that, Lord. Help me not to make false accusations. Help me not to make all these judgments and accuse. Now, an either or more or less, if it's a sin issue and the Bible's called it that, thou shalt not steal. The guy stole something, then that's a confrontation point. And it's an either or, and there's not much discussion about it. I'm not talking about those kinds. I'm talking about other behavior characteristics that we tend to make it black and white. Because the guy did not say yes for us moving into the apartment, he is not available. See, there's several options with that. He may be available, but not right now. It could be that God has very specifically directed him to another case, to another thing. I know of one staff man who really turned to me for some counsel very recently in another part of the country from here. And told me, he said, some years back I was in a ministry and we were having a conference over the Christmas period. My wife and I prayed about it. And our discernment was that God wanted me to take her home for Christmas. And I announced that to my leader. And guess what the leader told me? Where's your commitment? You're not committed. Anybody who's committed will give up going home for Christmas and stay here. That's an either or. You either are committed or you're not. If you are committed, you'll stay here. If you're not, you'll go home. That's a black and white case. Very legalistic view. Bang. And the guy said, well, we've prayed about it. We really believe this is God's will. He said, if you go, you are no longer on the team. You are no longer in Bible study with us. And you're only going to be welcome at the rallies, not at anything else. The guy said, look, I told you we prayed about it, and that's what we think God would have us do. He said, well, you know where you stand. So he took his wife home for Christmas. And he came back, and the guy did just what he said he'd do. No more on the team, no more in the Bible study. Within a very few weeks, his darling sweetheart died. That was the last time she got to see her parents. Their parents rejoiced in their sensitivity to know to come home. To make an absolute set of rules that are unbendable, that they're always black and white, without listening it out. If a person tells me, I prayed about it and I honestly believe that's what God wants me to do. And I said, are you sure of that? And they say, yeah. I said, man, you better do it. Even if I think it's wrong, I said, I'll tell you what I think if you want to hear it. But my counsel to you is obedience to God. That's a little heavy. Now, I'm not saying you destroy, that you do away with objectives. I'm not saying you do away with standards. I'm saying that you use a little bit of spiritual sensitivity, that the concept of individual differences is biblical. Jesus Christ did not respond to all of his men the same way. Can you see Jesus telling John to get behind me, Satan? No, he's the beloved disciple. And what about Thomas? Thomas got special treatment. You know, I had to say, boy, that's patience. That's real, you know, Jesus had a long endurance to be willing to show Thomas. He didn't treat him alike. Of the 12, who were the most sensitive, at least closest in to him? Peter, James, and John. And of those who? I thought that's what I get. That's the way I view that too. It's John and Peter, and it's pretty hard to tell. But those two were a little closer than James, in my opinion, as I read the Bible. At least Peter, James, and John, they were treated differently. And I'm not saying that you do away with standards. I'm saying you listen the guy out and don't be so quick to make it either or. That's a little more or less in here. Especially when you have an authoritative domination in your heart. That what you'd like to do is call a shot and have everybody mark time without any exceptions. It's awfully easy to do that thing that I heard Doug speaking about this morning. Yes, sir, who's... Yeah.
What about the thing about kind of like the thing, if a person does something, you kind of make these self-fulfilled prophecies. Well, if you do that, then this is what's going to happen. My experience has shown that...
You can tell him that. I don't think that's wrong.
Oh, really?
You don't think I don't think it's wrong to share with him how you see it. He says, I really think this is what God would have me do. I said, let me offer you some alternatives. That's usually the way I deal with it. I said, I see this possibility and that possibility and the other possibility. I might support that with Scripture. I might even ask him, would you mind praying through that one more time? You know, and then he says, that's the way it is. And I said, well, hallelujah, you better obey God. So that's the way I approach it. Now, I'm not saying, if a guy, if that's his pattern in life, you know, he's continually missing the Bible study, the football game's on or the television program, whatever, that's a different case. I'm talking about the fellow that's not his pattern. But suddenly there's been what looks like an exception. And if we treat it either or, that's going to be tough.
The tone of voice might have a lot to do with that.
How I come
across to him.
Yeah, and you can do it. You can condemn a fellow without raising your voice. You can have a very somber note in there. See, it can be very threatening. Especially, you don't even have to open your mouth. Your eyes can give it intensity. You can add them larger, or you can make them smaller, or you can just hold them the same. So you can add intensity from a lot of ways, and you come across threatening. So how do you soften that threat? I think some of the patterns we talked about. You know, a little smile. Change that tone. Make it softer and smoother. A little lower pitch. And you're right. Yes, it does. You can come across threatening with it. Or you can take a threatening situation and come across kind of mildly with it. I've sometimes come across where I'm mild, try to be mild and sensitive with it, but the information is very, very intense. See, some of the Scripture passages are frightening, aren't they? Don't you get fearful in behalf of, even I'll read some for me sometimes. Lord, please, don't let me do that. Or somebody else, the information is fearful. And that might cut him and tear him to shreds, but I'd like to avoid that myself. That if the Bible tears a man to pieces, if he sheds blood all over the room, you can rejoice. But if you cut him, I wonder about that. You see, a brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city, and their contentions are like the bars of a castle. But if the Bible cuts him, I can love him. I can help bind his wounds. He says, I'm all torn up. I say, man, I can see how you feel. I sinned. I said, I know how that is. You're talking to a pro. I'm really intimately familiar with sin. You tell it to me and see if I can identify it. The Bible says there's no temptation taking you that's any different from mine. Let's don't get in the spacing off here who's where. Sin is guilt before God. We got to get rid of that. See, you can deal with that. You can identify with a guy. You don't have to cut him. You can let the Word deal in his life. And you can do it so sensitively if you'll pray over it and just take a moment to think about it. And if you get onto this either or, you're going to end up judgmental in most cases. I believe it. The concrete here and now as opposed to the then and there. Don't go back and dredge up the sewer line. You know, the guy's confessed it. How many times do you want him to confess it? Deal with what's at hand now. Well, one thing I've known about you from years back, that you are a loser. And then you proceed to tell him how much he's a loser. Or someone the other day was telling me that they've had a new life change. They've been a Christian for a long time. They made a new commitment. God has done a new thing in their life. I certainly should avoid the old there and then. Let's talk about how it is now. This giving advice on the next point is, I think, probably qualified as unsolicited. Some fellow's talking to you and you just give him the advice. I think the alternative is to share some ideas. Joe, I can identify with that. I've seen that before. Let me share with you how a thing I found effective. Or you might say, let me share what the Bible says about that. As opposed to telling him, you do so and so. A lot of people are not open for us to tell them to go and do something. Now, do you see the point? I'm not saying you don't give advice. What I'm saying is the unsolicited thing where a guy's not open for that. And even if he is, I think it's a lot smoother pattern for you to just sort of share it across with him out of your life and experiences and out of the Word. That's just smoother. It's easier to take. It makes the feedback a little more tasty. Yes, sir.
I'd like to go back to the previous one.
Yes. Yes, it would. And in that case, you would need to see how it's tracking.
But how would you prevent that then rather than without getting
Well, on a case where it's a tract, then that's what the information would be. You would have to go back. But if you're dealing with an issue now, the temptation is to do what? To go back and dredge up those other 14 things that a guy's been involved in just to show him all the negatives in his life. But if the issue now is that that's his pattern, then you have to do that. That would be the here and now. The here and now is that you've extracted that pattern. That's the way that you've observed it. I think the plan would be, Joe, let me describe a thing I've observed. And you describe it based on the things you observed. And that is the behavior you're talking about. And you leave it sort of open-ended. If you don't know, don't make the inference. You ask the question. Joe, you just didn't have a good attitude about that. I'd rather ask him, what would you describe your attitude? How do you feel? What do you think was your attitude at that time? See, most guys can tell you fairly well. If I didn't agree with it, I might say, well, it gave me another impression. Would you be interested in my impression, how I felt about that? Then I would simply tell him that's the way I felt, not that's the way it is. It's a good point. Then and there, it might be you have to go back and get a pattern, but that's not the same thing I'm talking about. The exploration of alternatives as opposed to absolute answers or solutions. Another qualifying word, the concept of absolute. If the Bible says that's the way it is, then that's it. And I don't believe in any much discussion about that. The only question then is how to apply it. But I'm talking about things outside of that, that there may be several ways to do it. My daughter has 5 invitations to minister in different places. And she's really going through a struggle trying to find out. But we're exploring those alternatives. I consider all of them as possibilities, and she does too. I could tell her the one I'd like to see her take. Don't you think that's a temptation for a daddy to tell a daughter? I'd like for you to do that. Man, I struggle with that every day of my life when I'm with my kids. To keep from telling them what to do. They need to search it out before God. And if they don't get it right, as long as it's not a sin issue, I need to give them some option in that, even to get it wrong. That they traced it out and that's the best that they could do with it. And I'll offer them suggestions of alternatives. And I might ask them, have you considered this? Have you considered that? But to make it just an absolute, boy, I really have to watch it. The value to the recipient as opposed to the giver. It's of immense value to me, therefore I'm going to come down on it. Well, I've got my hobby horses too. And those hobby horses may not be appropriate for the other person. If I could find out what they consider of value and deal with those probably in a little different context than just focusing only on mine. That's part of putting on the right-hand side the focus you remember on our chart we started with, the focus on the receiver's end. You focus on what he's considering. Doesn't mean I won't get to mine now. But let's give attention where their values lie.
Could you give an example?
Let's see. All right, sir.
Start talking about something, and I put her down, and I remember. It's just for my benefit that I remember that. And I am loaded, and I feel great, and it just crushes her. And I say, "Boy, you've done it." And I will call her up to her, but I am loaded, and I say, "Boy, good, I'm free."
Yeah, and we'll have some like that. Time, being on time. Eats my lunch. I grew up, my daddy taught me to be on time. He said, it's awfully easy to be late. You know, you don't even try for that one. You can be early with not much effort, but it takes great skill to be right on time. So he said, instead of having to work at that skill, why don't you be early? You'll never be late if you're early. And that was such sound logic, I've never been able to refute that. And so I've been on that track all my life. When I got in the military, you know, we used to have little penalties for being late. It's called failure to repair. It's court-martial offense. So I was impressed with that. When I was learning to fly, they said, now, being on time is essential. Can you feature yourself over the middle of the Pacific Ocean with a plan to rendezvous with a tanker and you're late? Dang, that's a frightening message. You know, if you leap off on an attack before the artillery has been fired, you can get killed. Those are extreme cases. I don't like to show up in church late. It eats my lunch. And guess what we have? Every Sunday. T-minus 5. alive. Let's get it moving. And we're invariably a minute or two late, and I get all nervous and tense. That's of value to me. I told and told and told. I put it vertically and horizontally. And they don't hear what I'm saying. They don't do what I ask. That's of value to me, but it's obviously not much value to them. Yes, Dave. Yes, it may be.
And it may not be of value to the person.
Yeah, and I think we have to use judgment on that. I think the value to the recipient here would probably be that I need to consider that. And if it is not, then probably motivational. I need to show them what God said about that so that it then becomes their value. Because even if I tell them that's God's value, they may not respond to it. I keep running into that. Do you? I tell them, you know God didn't want you to do that. It's a lot different if you take the Bible and say, how about reading that? They read it and you discuss it if they can come up with it. Then it becomes their value. And until it does, it's an awfully tough deal to handle. But I think more than as opposed to looking at the things the Bible says. Now, I've tried to make that point all the way through. If the Bible says that's what it is, then it's not open to a whole lot of discussion for me. What I would like in my heart is a yes, sir. And what I want for my family is a yes, sir, to God. Now, that's a different case. So these are mostly shadings in and outs. They're personalized issues. And to deal primarily with where we're focusing on the left-hand side of the chart or on the right-hand side of the chart. You can relate nearly everything we've said back to that. Then there's the amount of information that I like to give as opposed to the amount of information they can honestly receive. A friend of mine years ago, Rich Cleveland, told me, he said, you know, as I started walking in spiritual life, my plan was to tell everything that moved everything I knew. And my wife heard that and she looked at me and she said, I believe that that's what you do. And I thought about that. And I nodded my head. And she told me not long ago, said, do you know, I believe you're still doing that. And that's right. I told you I knew some of them. There's some of them I don't know. Amount of information the recipient can use. I'd like to tell them the 15 things that are wrong with them. I like to straighten them out. Line them up and get this thing taken care of. But honestly, not many people can handle 10 or 12. Things that need to be done. Let me ask you just brutally, how many negatives are you able to deal with in your life at a given time? How many can you honestly work on?
One at a time.
Well, some of you can probably handle a few more. But most of us are more comfortable with one. Maybe two. Where Bob and I used to work, the responsibility I had was instructing our faculty in that, and it was a very strong personal opinion of mine, and I said, I suggest that you limit it to three significant ones and don't go more than that. And if you ever went more than that, guess what happened? You blew a guy right out of the chair. I had a colonel look me in the eye and say, Major, I don't want any of this Mickey Mouse. All I want to know is what I did wrong. Don't go into all this other stuff, but just setting the pace and rapport and all that. Just tell me what I did wrong, and I want to know all the details as quick and directly as you can give it. I said, yes, sir. So I had a list. And I said, sir, as you requested, here are several things that I found. And I went down the list. I said, these I consider significant. There were five or six. I said, and these I consider not so significant. I had a list of those. And after about seven or eight of them, he began to steam. His face turned red. He got angry. He just blew up. And denounced me, denounced the school, denounced the process and everything. And I thought, well, the next time I get told that, I'll smile. And I'll do it my way now. Because I'm working for that general that works in that other building. I don't work for that troop. That colonel, I didn't work for him. And I blew that. And I decided I'm not going to do that anymore. I'd like to give a fellow what he can handle. And then I'd like to choose what he can do. Something he can succeed at. We'll talk about that in a moment. Appropriate timing as opposed to inappropriate. If the guy's sick, he's ill, he's too emotionally disturbed, he's depressed, whatever. I may have to do it again on another time. I may need to even consider that about me and suggest, you know, I really am upset now about two or three other things. I think one more is going to make waves that nearly sink my ship. Could we do this tomorrow? A little honest feedback to look for timing. Focus on what is said as opposed to why it is said. Well, it seemed to me that you said this, and you can quote it. If you said, well, you said that because, what have you done when you complete that sentence? judgmental, you've attributed a motive. And I'd suggest you ask. I observed that this is what was said. It would sure help me to understand it if I could understand why. Would you share with me why you did that? One of the fellows that lived in our home for a while stopped me one day as I was coming downstairs. And he said, Bill, the thing I don't understand. He described the behavior that he had seen me. And he said, I don't understand why you did that. Well, I hadn't been aware of it. I thought about it and I said, well, now the answer is pretty simple. It's called sin. And now that you pointed it out, I honestly didn't see it, but I see it now. And I'd like to take care of it. So I said, if you don't mind, I'd like to pray. And he said, fine. So we bowed our heads and I asked God to forgive me. And then I looked at him and said, brother, I'd like to ask you to forgive me. He said, well, I already have. But he asked the question why. He didn't accuse me with it. And I've appreciated that. You may need to know why, but to ask it sensitively. Then you'll find as you develop and operate on the left side that it's a horizontal relationship that will develop trust. Trust will be established. You don't have to ask for it. But on the other side, you'll have to ask them, well, trust me with this. I know what's good. I know what's bad. Trust me. But on this side, you probably won't have to mention it. We talked about focusing on strengths as opposed to weaknesses. If there was a thing that really needed to be corrected, I'd like to develop for an individual to operate in his strength area, wouldn't you? I'd like him to, if he's effective in three or four things, I'd like for him to continue doing those. I'd like to see his life where he's using gifts and abilities that God has given to him. Now, I need to put some of those in order. I heard one fellow said, you know, I was with this gang and I did a thing that was wrong and I was told very directly. He said, a few weeks later, I did another thing. I was told about that. And after about the 10th time, I began to conclude that I only make mistakes, that I don't really get anything right. People like to be told that they're doing some things effectively. I don't mean to build them up or to get them into pride or anything like that. I mean a simple statement. The Lord provided us a replacement car. It's a 3-year-old rabbit, but it looked kind of new. And it operates kind of new. And I was so thankful for it. And I pulled up at a stoplight here in Colorado Springs. And I'm waiting on it to change. And bang! Guy ran into the back of me. You know, my first impulse was sin. I thought, you! And I got out of there. And then as I walked around the car, I began to get a little composure. You know, the old flesh leaped up there. Especially since I was downwind of the guy. And I could tell 6 paces that he was schnockered. And I thought, he's had it. So then I started praying for him. Well, Lord, help him now to get stabilized before the police get here. They did come and they arrested him on the spot. They put us both in the back of the cruiser. Do you know the one where the doors don't have a handle? It's a little nerve-nerving getting in that car like that. I've never been in one before. He slammed the doors and this cage all around it. And they're talking through the cage and they took down all the information and they did it quite nicely and it was over. And they said, now you're definitely not at fault and we're going to arrest this guy. There won't be any problem with your insurance because we're going to have this documented. And I told one officer, I said, I'd like to just share with you 3 things that I observed. I said, one, I observed that you got here in a timely fashion because it only took a few minutes. Yeah. And I said, I observed that you were very polite, both to that fellow and to me. You used the word sir several times, and he was really out of it. And you knew that he had caused the wreck, and a guy that's drunk, you could have been aggravated with him, and I didn't see that. So that was the second thing. I said, thirdly, you handled that paperwork very smoothly. You explained it to me and gave me a copy, and I appreciated that. I just want you to know that I consider that very effective police work, and I appreciate and admire your attitude about it. He couldn't speak. He waited a moment. He's a very big guy. He looked down at me and he said, you've made my day. He said, I've had a terrible day. Everywhere he turned, things were going wrong. I said, that didn't cost me a thing, and all that was true. Had I been guilty, now you could have suspected me of something else. But I wasn't guilty. But I'd like to see our men operate from strength, and I'd like us to take time to tell them. I'd like us to be an encourager. Be an encourager every day. But encourage one another every single day while it is yet today, lest you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Hebrews 3:13. That's a heavy. I might ask you, who have you encouraged today? I might ask you, who have you discouraged today? See, it takes very little to discourage. Successes as opposed to failures. How many times do you have to fail to be a failure? Some people once. What about twice? More people look at that. Three times? Three consecutive times of failing a thing. Will it enter your mind? I might not be able to do that. It enters most people's mind. And so the guy didn't do it. He might truly be a failure, but I'd like not to work at that. I'd like to find some successes. And that's what I tried to do with that young girl that the fellow told she was a failure. I tried to apply that principle. I was going to look for something she was a success at. I had no idea she was a giant success. I really didn't. It's only as we built that case up. So I think that's what I'm suggesting in feedback, that you give those kinds of responses to the people concerned. Now, suppose that someone has done something out of the order and you want to communicate to them in a critique session. You want to critique their performance, whatever it was, in evangelism, in Bible study, in a presentation they had made, how they cut the grass, whatever. I have three or four suggestions that you do, and I'll just give them to you. Just read them out. More as a checklist approach. Because to explain them would take another whole session we don't have. I think number one is you either establish or reestablish love and acceptance. If you already have the relationship, reestablish that. It only takes a minute. You can smile at them. You can just remind them of what they mean to you. Something that they've done in your life. Just some little positive thing to reestablish the love. Then I think you can begin by maybe enumerating a few of the positive issues in their life. You may begin by telling them a few positive issues in their life. Joe, there's one thing I've noticed about you. I had a young fellow with me that was in Bible study for a while. And he had very few skills and talents. But I kept reminding him of one or two. I said, you have such a genuine humility in your attitude that you're one of the few men that I know that I can honestly say it's deep-rooted, genuine humility. And another thing, and I told him a second one, he really had a servant's heart. All he had to do was see a thing that needed to be done, and he would do it without any recognition from anybody. Those two things have impressed me about him for a long time. And I've told him time and again, regardless of what's going on, I've told him that wherever I am, you're welcome to be there with me. See, that's an encouragement, a few positive things in the life. And then I think the number three would be to focus on the behavior that we talked about. This, in other words, use the principles of effective feedback that we just covered, the handout that you got. As you begin to focus on it. Now, that's where you focus on the behavior. See, you focus on the behavior as opposed to the person, meaning use effective feedback. You describe it in great detail. What you observed as you looked at the behavior. A fourth thing, offer specific suggestions to improve. Specific suggestions to improve. Now, that's tough. I found out years ago, any yo-yo can complain. You ain't got to be smart or sensitive or anything else to complain. You just relax and it'll happen. But it takes spiritual sensitivity to be able to offer some concrete suggestions on how to improve a thing. A sentence this way, I shared this with our faculty, and basically it was almost a requirement to complete the sentence. I suggest that. Force yourself into that box a little bit. I suggest that. Now offer some concrete and specific suggestion. See, you can tell a guy who gave a presentation, Joe, that introduction was poor. You need to work on your introduction. Don't you think Joe knew that introduction wasn't altogether good before you told him? And telling him that it's poor, did that achieve anything? Tell him you really need to work on it. Have you helped him? See, I'd suggest that you do something like this. Well, Joe, let's consider the introduction. I'd suggest that the presentation begin with an attention step. And then you talk about an attention step, what it should do. You see? And then you offer concrete suggestion. I suggest that. You might give him an illustration then. I've even taken a notepad and I said, let me offer this suggestion. I've written it out. How about that? Oh, yeah, hey, I can see that. And then a guy dies. See, he can respond to that. But it's so easy just to leave it with a negative and not offer the suggestion for improving. See, if I ask you, what's your objective when you talk to a guy like that? You're going to critique a performance. What is your really, really, honestly, what is your objective? Wouldn't you like to see him improve? Wouldn't you like to see him get it right? Well, then suggest to him how he can do it. We talk about the house, but when we come on with a critique, we rarely use them. I think Galatians 6, 1 and 2 is a key passage for that whole pattern. If your brother's taken in a fault or an offense, what are you supposed to do, you who are spiritual? You restore him. That's what you want. You want to see him restored, don't you? Yeah. What's your attitude? In a spirit of gentleness. One fellow told me some time ago, said, Bill, you're too gentle with this idea of trying to correct people. I said, well, let's see if I got this right. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, hardness. That doesn't ring right. That Galatians 6, 1 says, my attitude is to be one of gentleness. And if I'm coming on in anger or accusing or degrading or threatening, I'm out of order. I'm supposed to help him be restored with an attitude and a spirit of gentleness. And then Galatians 6, 2. What does that say? That very next verse tells us to do what? To bear one another's burdens. The context in my mind for Galatians 6, 2 is obviously Galatians 6, 1. Now, I'd ask the question, are you willing to help the guy be restored? Are you willing to take a responsibility? And if you're not willing to bear the burden and help him with it, I have to question whether you qualify for 6, 1. I really do. Some people don't believe that. A fellow called my hand on that yesterday. Say, well, the Bible says, the fifth verse of that says that you bear your own burdens. I said, yeah, the context of 5 is in 1 and 2. 5 has flowed after 1 and 2. And it relates, so then every one of us shall give account of himself to God. That means the man's not excused. But the context was to clarify that you're not excused, but the flow is help him be restored by bearing his burden. A young man said, what does rebuke mean? I said, what are you asking? He said, well, what do you do when you rebuke somebody? And I said, well, you remember the Bible study about 20 minutes ago? He said, yeah. And this subject came up? Yeah. And we looked in the Bible and saw that it was sin? Yeah. And I described to you some trouble I've had with it over the years? Yeah. And I described to you a couple of three things I observed in your life, and I asked you about them, and you said, yeah, that's the way it is. And you confess sin? Yeah. And then we looked at a pattern. You said you were sorry of that. You were looking to God for forgiveness. Yeah. And then you remember we looked at three things. 1 and 2 you were going to do. And 3, I was going to help you with it. He said, yeah, I remember all that. I said, that was rebuke. He said, it was. I said, yeah. You thought it was negative, didn't you? He said, yeah, I did. I said, so I'm supposed to come down on you and read you the riot act, tell you to shape up or ship out. Is that what I'm supposed to do? Well, no. I'm supposed to lose love and not be accepting and encouraging. No, he didn't think that's right. I said, what in the world is to be my behavior? I'm supposed to be loving and accepting. I'm to be encouraging. I'm to bear that burden with you and help you. I'm to take a responsibility to help you be restored. And my attitude, as directed by the Bible, is to be one of gentleness. See, that's the opposite end of an authoritative dominator who would enforce and demand and twist and destroy and cut down. How many dead bodies, so to speak, how many spiritually shattered bodies anyway have I run into who are no longer with us, and some of them you question if they're still walking with God. When you hear about it, it sounds like somebody cocked a double-barrel shotgun and fired point blank. It's no wonder the guy got blown out of the saddle because we so frequently violate it. So the thing offers specific suggestions is in the context of Galatians 6, 1 and 2. To be your brother to be restored, your attitude of gentleness, and to bear his burden with him and help him. And the fifth thing is very prayerfully from start to finish, ask God to make you an encourager or be an encourager. Hebrews 3:13. Now, God's commanded that. The tense of that verb is encourage one another. That's an emphatic tense, I'm told. I'm not a student of the Greek. But I've been told clearly that that's what it means. It's a directive in nature. It's not a suggestion. It says, you encourage one another every single day. So I thought, well, I sure need to pray about that. And I want to ask that God help me to be an encourager every day. And I think that you would need that too. Well, this then is one or two applications. The concept of effective feedback and the use of a critique. Now, the next few days that you're here, I believe a point of application is as you communicate in private with the guys in the room, as those men in your seminar, as you interact with other seminars, ask God to help you to apply these communication principles, that your communication will be undergirded with God's grace and seasoned with salt, that you might know how you ought to answer every person. I think that's key. Well, what I'd like for us to do is to take a break.